content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the December 2nd, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's cabinet taking shape. What happened? Donald Trump continued to form his administration this week, nominating three staunch conservatives for senior national security positions and unveiling his plans for his first acts as president. The president-elect named Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions as his attorney general, Representative Mike Pompeo of Kansas as CIA chief, and retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn as White House national security advisor. Congressional Republicans praised the nominations, but Democrats voiced objections to Flynn, who has said Islam is not a religion, but a political ideology, and Sessions, who was once denied a federal judgeship after being accused of making racist comments. In a surprise move, Trump met with one of his fiercest Republican critics, 2012 presidential nominee Mitt Romney, as a potential pick for Secretary of State. He was also considering retired General James Mattis for Defense Secretary and investment banker Steven Mnuchin as Treasury Secretary. Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach, a candidate for Homeland Security Chief, was photographed holding a plan that included restarting a controversial registry of immigrants from Muslim-majority countries. In a YouTube video, Trump promised to take several executive actions on his first day as president, including withdrawing the U.S. from the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, removing limits on domestic energy production, and introducing new restrictions on government officials moving into lobbying. The president-elect also gave a wide-ranging interview to the New York Times, in which he disavowed his alt-right supporters and suggested he was disinclined to launch a criminal investigation into his former opponent, Hillary Clinton, saying it would be very, very divisive for the country. What the editorial said. President-elect Trump is making some dangerous appointments, said the Washington Post. Pompeo was one of the more fanatical purveyors of conspiracy theories about the terrorist attacks on Benghazi. Flynn is a respected military tactician with considerable experience fighting al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Iraq, but he has worrying links to Russia. He sat next to President Vladimir Putin at an event for RT, the country's propaganda outlet, and was sacked as head of the Defense Intelligence Agency for bad management. Flynn has tweeted that fear of Muslims is rational. His influence in the White House could presage a harsh and counterproductive U.S. approach to the Muslim world. What's encouraging is that Trump appears to be looking for figures of stature outside his inner circle, said the Wall Street Journal. Pompeo, a talented Army veteran and Harvard Law graduate, is the president-elect's most impressive appointment yet. And although Trump may not make Romney his Secretary of State, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley and former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani are also under consideration. The outreach to a former antagonist shows a willingness to expand his governing coalition and unify the GOP. What the columnist said. Back in April, Trump promised he'd become so presidential if elected, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. We're still waiting. The president-elect's tweets are as angry and petty as ever, and he refuses to address concerns over his conflicts of interest and nepotism. His nominations of angry white male conservatives indicate that his election night promise to bind the wounds of division was empty rhetoric. There's one thread that runs through these appointments, white nationalism, said Jamelle Bouie in Slate.com. Sessions, Flynn, and Chief Strategist Steve Bannon have all made it clear they believe in the political and cultural dominance of white Americans. With them in charge, we can expect the Trump administration to pursue discriminatory policy on voting, to empower local police departments to operate with impunity against communities of color, and to curtail the rights and freedoms of innocent Muslims. Sorry, but the media's incessant scaremongering is way out of proportion, said Kyle Smith in the New York Post. Every move by the Trump transition team is greeted with hysteria. By keeping the outrage meter up to 11 at all times, the media risks desensitizing people so much they'll shrug off any genuine White House scandals that do arise. The media should at least wait until Inauguration Day before it declares the end of the world. And a second main story. Trump University settles fraud suits for $25 million. What happened? Putting to rest years-old fraud allegations, Donald Trump agreed last week to pay $25 million to settle three lawsuits in California and New York brought by 7,000 former students of Trump University, his now-defunct real estate seminar program. The settlement, announced days before one of the lawsuits was set to go to trial in San Diego, removes a legal cloud that had hovered over Trump's presidential transition. Former Trump University students claim they were charged as much as $35,000 for courses that promised to teach them Trump's real estate investment secrets, but proved largely worthless. In sworn testimony, former Trump University managers testified that salespeople were trained to pressure attendees to buy additional pricey seminars, and that the enterprise, which falsely claimed that Trump handpicked the instructors, was a fraudulent scheme. During his campaign, Trump had drawn controversy for alleging that Indiana-born federal judge Gonzalo Curiel, who oversaw two of the cases, was biased against him because of Curiel's Mexican heritage. Trump had repeatedly called the lawsuits baseless and vowed never to settle, and as part of the final settlement, did not admit to any wrongdoing. "The only bad thing about winning the presidency," Trump tweeted, "is that I did not have the time to go through a long but winning trial on Trump U. Too bad." What the columnist said. These suits revealed an ugly fact about the president-elect, said Libby Nelson in Vox.com. For decades, Trump has led his admirers to believe that he'd use his power, wealth, and knowledge to help them. In reality, his standard operating procedure has been to exploit others to enrich himself. The people who fell for the Trump University sales pitch looked a lot like Trump's base and sincerely believed the celebrity mogul wanted to bring them wealth. Little did they know Trump's mission was to separate gullible people from their money. The settlement was clearly an effort to prevent a major embarrassment on the eve of Trump's inauguration, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. Had the San Diego trial gone forward, the nation would have watched a succession of witnesses explain how Trump University used false advertising and promises to lure them into parting with their life savings, or about how Trump approved the company's ads but never attended the seminars or even reviewed the curricula. Avoiding such a spectacle was surely worth a lot more than $25 million to the future commander-in-chief. "This won't be the end of Trump's legal troubles," said Paul Callan in CNN.com. "He'll still have to worry that potential litigants will be emboldened by these settlements to pursue cases of their own against him." Indeed, a nationwide study by USA Today revealed that Trump currently has at least 75 open lawsuits against him and his business, a historic number of legal matters for an incoming president. In all likelihood, Trump will be coughing up substantial coin to make these lawsuits go away for some time to come. The controversy of the week, Trump's businesses, an unprecedented conflict of interest. Donald Trump ran and won on a promise to drain the swamp of corruption and self-dealing in government, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. But it's already starting to look as if his real plan is to deepen the muck and make his fabulously wealthy family even wealthier. The president-elect owns or has stakes in at least 500 companies, 111 of which do business overseas. The sprawl extends across Asia, South America, and the Middle East, and includes such countries as Saudi Arabia, China, India, and Turkey. His businesses also owe hundreds of millions of dollars to banks in China and Germany, and perhaps Russia. That's a massive and unprecedented conflict of interest. When dealing with countries where he does business, will Trump put his own financial interest aside and do what's best for the U.S.? Trump's supposed solution is to let his adult children run his company while he retains ownership, said Pat Garofalo in USNews.com. That's no blind trust. In fact, it's a joke. Since the election, Trump has let Eric, Donald Jr., and Ivanka Trump serve on his transition team, met with business partners from Pune, India, where he is developing a pair of towers, and invited Ivanka to sit in on meetings with the Japanese prime minister. Clearly, Trump intends to turn the presidency into an arm of his family business. The law's totally on my side, Trump said this week. The president can't have a conflict of interest. What this means, said Paul Waldman in the WashingtonPost.com, is that it will now be ridiculously easy to bribe the U.S. president. Any foreign dictator wanting a favor from Trump, say Vladimir Putin, can simply arrange for a local developer to pay Trump hundreds of millions of dollars to license his name, or hire the Trump organization as consultants, or sell the company land at a big discount. Untold sums could flow into Trump's pockets, and since he'll never release his tax returns, no one will know. The influence buying has already begun, said Jonathan O'Connell, also in WashingtonPost.com. Since the election, the new Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., has been hustling for business from diplomats and foreign dignitaries who are eager to give Trump their money. I can tell the new president, I love your new hotel, explained one Asian diplomat. Trump is right about one thing. None of this is illegal, said Eric Levitz in NYMag.com. Presidents are exempt from the conflict of interest statutes that apply to most elected officials. Some experts say that Trump risks violating the Constitution's emoluments clause, which bars office holders from accepting gifts from any king, prince, or foreign state. But the law has rarely been enforced, and there's no binding precedent for its interpretation. Unless Congress or the courts step in, said Josh Voorhees in Slate.com, the only hope is that Trump voluntarily follows the accepted norms of ethical behavior, and it's no secret how he feels about those. Trump will give Democrats a big fat target if he doesn't address this problem, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. To avoid serious political damage, he has to liquidate his stake in the Trump Organization and put the proceeds in a true blind trust run by an independent manager. The sale would be painful and perhaps costly for Trump, but millions of Americans have put their trust in him to improve their lives, not treat the presidency as a brief hiatus from his business. If he's serious about cleaning up Washington's culture of self-dealing, he's going to have to make a sacrifice and lead by example. In our good week, bad week section, it was a good week for checking out. After entrepreneurs opened the first divorce hotel in upstate New York, allowing guests to check in married and check out single, all in one weekend. It doesn't need to be the worst experience in your entire life, said a divorce mediator. It was a good week for alone time, after an international study found that highly intelligent people tend to be happier when they spend more time alone, working on their goals and interests, and less time socializing with other people. It was a good week for vengeance, after Donald Trump supporters started an online campaign urging like-minded coffee drinkers to use the name of the president-elect when ordering at Starbucks. The goal is to force the young, presumably liberal baristas to call out Trump every time an order is ready. But it was a bad week for mailing weed, after a report from the U.S. Post Office Inspector General revealed that postal employees are stealing most of the marijuana that is found while being illegally shipped through the mail. After suspicious packages are quarantined, they're stored in unsupervised and unlocked areas. It was a bad week for media literacy after a Stanford University study found that 82% of middle schoolers couldn't distinguish a real news story on a website from a sponsored content post by a business. And it was a bad week for getting a callback, after a Japanese man admitted to stealing the wallet of a company president during his job interview. I wanted to work for that company, said Shogo Takeda, 24, after confessing to the crime. But since I haven't got a job, I needed money. And while we're here, a boring but important short. Obama blocks Arctic drilling. President Obama banned new oil and gas drilling in the Arctic Ocean this week, 2 months before Donald Trump's inauguration, making it nearly impossible for the Republican president-elect to allow U.S. drilling in the area in the near future. Obama's five-year offshore plan allows oil exploration to proceed in Alaska's Cook Inlet, but blocks the sale of drilling rights in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas north of Alaska. Environmentalists argued that Arctic drilling would exacerbate climate change and endanger whales and other sea life. Trump has expressed skepticism that climate change is real, but to reverse Obama's ban, he would have to restart a regulatory review process that could take as long as 2 years to complete. Turning now to the briefing page, the crippled International Criminal Court. Russia just announced it is joining South Africa in withdrawing from the ICC. Is international justice doomed? What is the ICC? It's the one place in the world where genocide can be prosecuted. Headquartered in The Hague, Netherlands, the International Criminal Court weighs evidence of the worst crimes on the planet, crimes against humanity, including genocide and systematic torture. The ICC is a court of last resort to bring the world's monsters to justice, and it hears a case only if the state where the atrocity occurred is unable or unwilling to convene a fair trial, either because a conflict has decimated the justice system or because the accused is in power. There is no jury. Instead, a panel of judges decides each case. Over 14 years, just four people have been convicted, three Congolese warlords and one Malian extremist. How did it come to be? The court began operating in 2002, but its roots go back to the end of World War II. After the Nazi concentration camps were liberated and the Allies held war crimes trials in Nuremberg and Japan, international leaders began discussing ways to ensure that such hideous crimes could not happen again. In 1948, the newly formed United Nations adopted the Genocide Convention, and the year after that, the Geneva Conventions, which lay out wartime rules for the treatment of wounded soldiers, prisoners of war, and civilians. But there was no court that could prosecute offenders, and many atrocities went unpunished. Then in the 1990s, two horrifying events rekindled calls for an international court. The Yugoslav civil wars, which brought concentration camps back to Europe, and the Rwanda genocide, in which 800,000 people were slaughtered in just 100 days. An appalled UN set up special tribunals to try war crimes for both these conflicts, and the Rome Statute, the treaty that created the court, was signed in 1998. From the beginning, though, the court suffered a crisis of legitimacy. What hampered it? At its inception, the court was seen as a godsend for Africa. Our own continent has suffered enough horrors emanating from the inhumanity of human beings toward human beings, said Nelson Mandela when he signed the treaty. Many of these might not have occurred, or at least been minimized, had there been an effectively functioning international criminal court. But the largest world powers, including the U.S., did not join. The Clinton administration signed the treaty, but by the time it came into force in 2002, with 60 ratifications, the Bush administration decided to unsign it, saying it could put U.S. soldiers at risk of prosecution. Russia signed but did not ratify, and China and India didn't sign at all. Most of Africa, South America, and Europe did join, but after a few years, many African countries said the court was biased against Africans. Is that charge true? Of the 39 people who have been indicted, all are Africans, including Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, former Ivorian President Laurent Gbagbo, and Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. But that alone isn't evidence of bias. Most of the cases were referred to the court by African governments themselves. The current prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda of Gambia, points out that the victims of the crimes for which the indictees are being prosecuted have also been Africans, people with no hope of getting justice in their own countries. Bensouda was appointed in 2012 expressly to combat the ICC's image as anti-African, and she has opened preliminary investigations into possible war crimes in Georgia, Afghanistan, Colombia, Iraq, Palestine, and Ukraine. But Africans are not appeased. Sherif Bojang, Gambia's information minister, calls the ICC a court for the persecution and humiliation of people of color. Who has quit the ICC? South Africa was first last month. Its government ignored the ICC indictment and failed to arrest Sudan's Bashir when he visited South Africa for a regional conference this year. South Africa says it can't fulfill its role as the continent's peace broker if it's expected to arrest the warring leaders. Gambia and Burundi followed, and Kenya and other African states may too. Last week, Russia withdrew from the court altogether after the ICC issued a report calling the annexation of Crimea an occupation. Russia's exit is symbolic since Russia never ratified the treaty. But Cambridge University law professor Sarah Nowen says every withdrawal hurts. The smaller the court's jurisdiction, the more selective it will be seen as operating. Will the court survive? In diminished form, perhaps, but the court is headed for even greater opposition in the coming months. The ICC is about to open an official investigation into possible war crimes committed in Afghanistan from 2002 to 2005, some by the Taliban, but others by U.S. forces. Charges against Americans are unlikely, as the prosecutor would have to show that the U.S. failed to address allegations of torture through its own justice system. But the mere existence of an investigation is likely to harden U.S. opposition to the court. President-elect Donald Trump has already said he wants to bring back waterboarding and go tougher in terrorism interrogations. So cooperation between a Trump administration and the ICC is all but ruled out. And we're moving into the best columns of the week. We'll read two from the U.S. The first, Identity Politics Cost Liberals the Election. The Democrats' fixation on diversity has turned into an all-encompassing obsession that cost them the election, said Mark Lilla. The moral principles underlying identity politics are valid and have many good effects. Affirmative action has brought minorities into all-white workplaces. Black Lives Matter delivered a wake-up call to every American with a conscience. And liberal culture's efforts to normalize homosexuality produced a sea change in how families and society treat gays. But Democrats have become so focused on racial, gender, and sexual identity, it's made them indifferent to people outside their designated disadvantaged groups. During the presidential campaign, Hillary Clinton too often campaigned as a champion of women, Latinos, African Americans, and gays. That message left white, rural, and religious people feeling excluded. In the end, two-thirds of Americans without college degrees and 80% of white evangelicals voted for Trump. Blaming their defeat on a white lash will only allow liberals to continue to write off half the country, while waiting for demographics to save them. To win national elections, Democrats need to shift their focus away from identity politics and return to emphasizing Americans' shared destiny. Bring back pork barrel spending. House Republicans are considering bringing back pork barrel spending, and for the good of our country, they should, said Chris Ciliza. Earmarks, as Congress calls member items in which federal funds are doled out to museums, programs, highways, and other projects in their districts, were banned when Republicans took control of the House in 2010, as evidence they were cleaning up Washington. While banning these handouts sounded good in theory, the fact is that Congress works better when it actually works. And pork barrel spending was the grease that kept the legislative wheels turning. Legislative leaders use these allocations to get the votes of reluctant members and cut deals on important legislation addressing major national problems. In the year that the earmark ban went into effect, the government spent $16.5 billion on pork barrel projects, just a small fraction of the $3.8 trillion budget that year. Since that spending disappeared, compromise has ground to a halt, and Congress has been largely paralyzed. Earmarking may not be the way government should work, but it is the way the government does work, and did for more than two centuries. So bring it back. This from an international column from Namibia. Don't use climate change as a scapegoat. Namibian leaders can't blame global warming for the country's water emergency, said Victoria Shifidi. Experts say that the Vaanbach Dam, the main water supply dam for the capital, Windhoek, will be dry by the end of the year. Already, livestock are dying of thirst, and villagers have begun drinking unsafe well water because water has stopped flowing from their taps. The government says this crisis is a result of climate change, but it's letting itself off the hook. We may be in a major drought, but it's not unprecedented, and it's not the worst in the country, not the worst the country has faced. In fact, our current water crisis seems to emanate more from poor management than from the weather. Authorities have approved water-intensive projects such as breweries and chicken farms in dry areas, and there are practically no regulations on water pollution. Factories, hotels, and individuals continue to pollute streams, waterways, and subsequently dams with no repercussions whatsoever. We aren't suffering from physical water scarcity so much as economic water scarcity. That is both the good news and the bad. Better resource management can solve the problem, but our nation's leaders tend to lose momentum whenever it starts raining well again. Move now to the last word, our in-depth article, taken this week from the New York Times Magazine, titled, In Thrall to Adderall. Like many young people, I relied for years on prescription stimulants to power me through all-nighters in college and late nights at the office, said writer Casey Schwartz. Then I tried to kick my addiction. Have you ever been to Enfield? I had never even heard of it until I was 23 and living in London for graduate school. One afternoon, I received notification that a package whose arrival I had been anticipating for days had been bogged down in customs and was now in a FedEx warehouse in Enfield, an unremarkable London suburb. I was on the train within the hour. The package in question, sent from Los Angeles, contained my monthly supply of Adderall. The train to Enfield was hardly the greatest extreme to which I would go during the decade I was entangled with Adderall. I would open other people's medicine cabinets, root through trash cans where I had previously disposed of pills, write friends' college essays for barter. Once, while living in New Hampshire, I skipped a day of work to drive 3 hours each way to the clinic where my prescription was still on file. Never was I more resourceful or unswerving than when I was devising ways to secure more Adderall. Adderall is prescribed to treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, a neurobehavioral condition marked by inattention, hyperactivity, and impulsivity that's predominantly seen in children. That condition, which has also been called attention deficit disorder, has been increasingly diagnosed over recent decades. In the 1990s, an estimated 3 to 5% of school-aged American children were believed to have ADHD. By 2013, that figure was 11%. It continues to rise. And the increase in diagnoses has been followed by an increase in prescriptions. In 1990, 600,000 children were on stimulants, usually Ritalin. By 2013, 3.5 million children were on stimulants, and in many cases, the Ritalin had been replaced by Adderall, officially brought to the market in 1996 as the new upgraded choice for ADHD, more effective, longer lasting. By the mid-2000s, adults were the fastest-growing group receiving the drug. In 2012, roughly 16 million Adderall prescriptions were written for adults between ages 20 and 39. Adderall has now become ubiquitous on college campuses. Black markets have sprung up at many, if not most, schools. In fact, according to a 2012 article, the off-label use of prescription stimulants had come to represent the second most common form of illicit drug use in college by 2004. Only marijuana was more popular. To date, there is no research on the long-term effects on humans of using Adderall. In a sense, then, we are the walking experiment. Those of us around my age who first got involved with this drug in high school or college, when it was suddenly everywhere, and then did not manage to get off it for years afterward, if we got off it at all. We are living out what it might mean, both psychologically and neurologically, to take a powerful drug we do not need over long stretches of time. Sometimes I think of us as Generation Adderall. The first time I took Adderall, I was a sophomore at Brown University, lamenting to a friend the impossibility of my plight, a five-page paper due the next afternoon on a book I had only just begun reading. "Do you want an Adderall?" she asked. "I can't stand it. It makes me want to stay up all night doing cartwheels in the hallway." Could there be a more enticing description? My friend pulled two blue pills out of tinfoil and handed them to me. An hour later, I was in the basement of the library in a state of ecstasy. The world fell away. It was only me locked in a passionate embrace with the book I was reading and the thoughts I was having about it, which tumbled out of nowhere and built into what seemed an amazing pile of riches. When dawn came, I was hunched over in the grubby lounge of my dormitory, typing my last fevered perceptions, vaguely aware that outside the window, the sky was turning pink. I was alone in my new secret world, and that very aloneness was part of the great intoxication. I needed nothing and no one. I would experience this same sensation again and again over the next 2 years, whenever I could get my hands on Adderall on campus, which was frequently, but not, I began to feel, frequently enough. Adderall wiped away the question of willpower. Now I could study all night, then run 10 miles, then breeze through that week's New Yorker. It was fantastic. I lost weight. That was nice, too. I did snap at friends, though, abruptly accessing huge depths of fury I wouldn't have thought I possessed. By my senior year of college, my schoolwork had grown more unmanageable, not less. For the first time in my life, I wasn't able to complete it. My Russian history professor granted me an extension on the final term paper. One Friday evening, well into December, I was alone in the sciences library, the one that stayed open all night, squinting down at my notes on the Russian intelligentsia. Outside, it was blizzarding. I felt dizzy and strange. It had been a particularly chemical week. Several days had passed since I had slept more than a handful of hours, and I was taking more and more pills to compensate. Suddenly, when I looked up from the page, the bright room seemed to dilate around me, as if I weren't really there, but rather stuck in some strange mirage. An hour later, I was in an ambulance being taken through the snowstorm to the nearest hospital. I sat for hours in the ER until I was ushered behind a curtain and a skeptical-looking doctor came in to see me. I described what I'd been taking. His diagnosis? Anxiety, amphetamine-induced. I had had my first panic attack, an uncommon but by no means unknown reaction to taking too much Adderall. A few days later, I drew incompletes in my classes and went back home to New York. I spent that long winter break soldiering lethargically through the essays I hadn't been able to cope with while taking amphetamines. What I didn't know then, what I couldn't have known, was that the question of whether Adderall actually improves cognitive performance when taken off-label, whether or not it is a smart drug, was unresolved. It would be another few years before studies appeared showing that Adderall's effect on cognitive enhancement is more than a little ambiguous. Martha Farah, a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of Pennsylvania, has conducted much of this research. She has studied the effect of Adderall on subjects taking a host of standardized tests that measure restraint, memory, and creativity. On balance, Farah and others have found very little to no improvement when their research subjects confront these tests on Adderall. Ultimately, she says, it is possible that lower performing people actually do improve on the drug, and higher performing people show no improvement or actually get worse. My pill-free period didn't last very long. I turned in my incomplete schoolwork and duly received my grades. But by graduation that spring, I was again locked into a familiar pattern. the blissful intensity and isolation followed by days of slow motion come down when I would laze around for hours, barely able to muster the energy necessary to take a shower. It took me exactly 1 year from the time of college graduation to come to the decision that would, to a great extent, shape the next phase of my life. It hit me like a revelation. It might be possible to declare my independence from the various ADHD kids who sold me their prescription pills at exorbitant markups and get a prescription all my own. The idea occurred to me as I walked among the palm trees on the campus of UCLA. By then, I was living in Los Angeles, working as a private tutor for high school kids, many of whom were thinking who themselves were on Adderall, and taking summer school classes in psychology and neuroscience in order to be able to apply for graduate school. As soon as it occurred to me that I might be able to get my own prescription, I went to the nearest campus computer and searched for Cognitive Behavioral Psychiatrist, Westwood, Los Angeles, California. The very next day, I was describing to the young psychiatrist in the chair opposite me how I had always had to develop elaborate compensatory strategies for getting through my schoolwork, how staying with any one thing was a challenge for me, how I was best at jobs that required elaborate multitasking like waitressing. Untrue, all of it. I was a focused student and a terrible waitress. And yet these were the answers I discovered from the briefest online research that were characteristic of the ADHD diagnostic criteria. These were the answers they were looking for in order to pick up their pens and write down Adderall, 20 milligrams, once a day, on their prescription pads. So these were the answers I gave. 50 minutes later, I was standing on San Vicente Boulevard in the bright California sun, prescription slip in hand. That single doctor's assessment, granted in less than an hour, would follow me everywhere I went. Through the rest of my time in Los Angeles, then to London, then to New Haven, Connecticut, where I would pick it up once a month at the Yale Health Center, then back to New York, where the doctor I found on my insurance plan would have no problem continuing to prescribe this medication, based only on my saying that it had been previously prescribed to me, that I'd been taking it for years. Occasionally, I would try to get off the drug. Each attempt began the same way. Step one, the rounding up of all the pills in my possession, including those secret stashes hidden away in drawers and closets, debating for hours whether to keep just one for emergencies, then the leap of faith and the flushing of the pills down the toilet. Step two, a day or two of feeling all right, as if I could manage this after all. Step three, a bleak slab of time when the single effort needed to get through even a simple task of a single day felt stupendous. Panic would set in, then suddenly an internal Adderall voice would take over, and I would jump up from my desk and scurry out to refill my prescription or borrow pills from a friend if need be. I've often wondered whether my inability to give it up was my deepest failing. I found some comfort in seeing my own experience mirrored back to me in the dozens and dozens of disembodied voices on the internet, filling the message boards of the websites devoted to giving up this drug. One post in particular had stayed with me, a mother writing on quittingadderall.com. I started taking Adderall in October 2010, and my story isn't much different than most. The honeymoon period, then all downhill. I feel like I cannot remember who I was or how I felt to go 1 minute of the day not on Adderall. I look back at pictures of myself from before this began, and I wonder how I was ever happy without it, because now I am a nervous wreck if I even come close to not having my pills for the day. I was 30 by the time I got off Adderall for good. This statement horrifies me even now, more than 3 years later, recognizing the amount of precious time I gave away to that drug. During my first weeks of finally giving up Adderall, the fatigue was as real as it had been before. The effort required to run even a tiny errand momentous, the gym unthinkable. The cravings were a force of their own. If someone so much as said Adderall in my presence, I would instantly begin to scheme about how to get just one more pill, or maybe two. I was anxious, terrified I had done something irreversible to my brain, terrified that I was going to discover that I couldn't write at all without my special pills. One of those earliest days of being off the drug, I was moving slowly, more than a little daunted, trying to walk the few miles to an appointment I had in Midtown Manhattan. It was a glorious summer evening, the sun just going down. As I approached Bryant Park, I heard live music and wandered in to see. A rock band was performing on stage. The singer gripped the microphone with two hands, pouring his heart into every word. Suddenly, tears were streaming down my face. I was embarrassed, but I couldn't stop. It was as if I hadn't heard music in years. Read one of the obituaries for you this week. The news anchor who broke down racial barriers, Gwen Ifill, 1955 to 2016. When Gwen Ifill watched the news as a child, the anchors and reporters she saw on screen were almost all white men. There was no one, she said, who looked like me in any way. No women, no people of color. So Ifill set out to change that. In a trailblazing TV career, she rose to become the first black woman to anchor a major weekly news show, PBS's Washington Week, and the first to moderate a vice presidential debate. On PBS, she and Judy Woodruff formed the first all-female anchor team on a nightly network news show. I'm very keen about the fact that a little girl now watching the news, when they see me and Judy sitting side by side, it will occur to them that that's perfectly normal, Ifill said in 2013, that it won't seem like any big breakthrough at all. Born in New York City, Ifill lived a semi-nomadic life growing up because her Panamanian immigrant father pastored at African Methodist Episcopal churches across the Northeast, said the Los Angeles Times. At Simmons College in Boston, she secured an internship at the Boston Herald American when a coworker sent her a racist note. Her editors were so embarrassed by the incident that she was hired upon graduation. Ifill started writing about politics and quickly rose through the ranks with spells at the Baltimore Evening Sun, the Washington Post, and the New York Times. In 1994, after 2 years at the Times, White House correspondent Ifill made the leap to broadcast journalism, said the Washington Post. Covering Capitol Hill for NBC, she quickly established herself as a smart, no-nonsense broadcaster, and in 1999 moved to PBS to host Washington Week. 5 years later, she moderated the 2004 vice presidential debate between Dick Cheney and John Edwards. Ifill broke ground again in 2013 when she and Woodruff became co-host of PBS's NewsHour. Despite her success, Ifill always saw herself more as a reporter than as a news anchor, program host, or moderator, said the New York Times. She said she loved covering presidential politics because it allowed her to talk to so many different people. But she insisted she'd never want to run for office herself. It's much more fun to watch and to ask, she said, than to actually have to account for your behavior. And we'll read one of the health and science articles. Supercharging statins. Statins have become the gold standard for the treatment of high cholesterol, And a new type of drug known as PCSK9 inhibitors can make them even better. In a recent study, researchers split a group of 968 volunteers into two groups, one taking only a statin, the other combining the drug with evolocumab, a PCSK9 inhibitor. After 18 months, the team measured the participants' levels of LDL, or bad cholesterol. Anything below 100 milligrams per deciliter of blood is considered excellent. And those who were taking only a statin averaged an impressive 93 milligrams per deciliter. But those taking a combination of the two drugs averaged an astonishing 36 milligrams per deciliter. An ultra-low level generally seen only in babies. In a sense, said cardiologist Elliot Antman, who wasn't associated with the study, you are turning back the cardiovascular clock. These striking reductions came with an added benefit, reports Reuters.com. Greater declines in dangerous plaques that had accumulated in the patient's arteries. Plaques shrank in two-thirds of those taking both drugs, but in only half of those taking a statin alone. The only downside of PCSK9 inhibitors is their cost. With some prescriptions priced at $14,000 a year, most insurers are refusing to pay for them. And the health scare of the week, teenage depression rising. The number of young Americans battling depression rose by more than a third in the decade leading up to 2014. In a review of surveys completed by more than 170,000 teens, researchers from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health found that 6% of boys suffered a major depressive episode in 2014, up from 4% in 2005. Among girls, the figure soared from 13% to more than 17%. It's unclear what's behind this worrying trend and why girls are more at risk. Researchers noted that social media use and cyberbullying are much more prevalent among girls, which could make them more vulnerable to depression. Complicating matters, the number of teens being treated for the disorder remains unchanged. This suggests many young people are suffering in silence, increasing their risk for suicide, reports NBCNews.com. Ramin Mojtabai, the study's leader, said it was imperative that we find ways to reach these teenagers and help them manage their depression. And we'll move right over to the talking points page. Fake news. How the media lost its influence. We are living on the edge of an information crisis, said David Zurarek in the Baltimore Sun. A new analysis by BuzzFeed.com found that 20 fake election stories generated more Facebook engagement during the home stretch of the campaign than did real news from 19 major outlets combined. All but three of the fake stories were overtly pro-Donald Trump, including a story claiming Clinton sold weapons to ISIS and another claiming the Pope had endorsed Trump. Facebook has said it will create a task force to tackle the issue, but that won't solve the underlying problem, said Gregory Fahrenstein in WashingtonPost.com. A recent Gallup poll found that trust in the media is at a historic low of 32%. Down 28 points since 2005. Thanks to the proliferation of highly partisan and conspiracy theory sites online, people are becoming immune to any information that contradicts their beliefs, dismissing news and opinions they don't like as biased. The mainstream media has only itself to blame, said David Harsanyi in TheFederalist.com. Perched in their ivory towers on the East and West coasts, most journalists have little understanding of what middle America is thinking. Their contempt for Trump and insistence that he had zero chance of winning only gave Trump-minded voters solid reasons not to believe the media and to retreat to fringe or hoax alternatives. Americans on both the right and the left are trapped in their partisan echo chambers, said Alfred Hermida in Salon.com. Facebook and other social media have only made this phenomenon worse, creating a personalized stream of information designed to envelop users in the cozy embrace of the familiar. On social media, emotion and virality rule, not truth. Democracy fails if the populace is uninformed, misinformed, or disinformed, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post. Rebuilding trust in legitimate journalism is now perhaps the greatest challenge of our time. News organizations need to work harder at presenting balanced reporting that represents the perspectives of both red and blue America. And newspapers should stop engaging in advocacy journalism, in which they mix real reporting with an obvious agenda. Objectivity be damned. Still, it's unlikely there will be a solution to this problem without the support of our next president. After all, Donald Trump did more than anyone to convince Americans that the media are our enemy. And just a short note as we finish up, away from the East and West Coast, Republicans now so dominate the country that a traveler could drive 3,600 miles across the continent from Key West, Florida to the Canadian border at Port Hill, Idaho, without ever crossing a blue state. On the poll watch, President-elect Donald Trump's favorability rating has grown to 46% after the election. Prior to his win, it was 37%. Similarly, his unfavorability rating has dropped from 61% to 46%. And we'll finish the hour with a quote from Dan Rather. He says, "Americans will put up with anything as long as it doesn't block traffic." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service would like to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.